Good afternoon. So last time, we finished up talking about running programs, talking about weight PID, and this function that is the interface for asking to wait for a program that we've started. So we can choose the PID of a child process, and we wait for it and collect status info. And well, when I say wait for, well, we wait for it if we need to. If it's already exited, we just get its status info, and the OS is going to keep that around so we can collect it and figure out, like, why did this program exit? Did it seg fault? Did something else happen? And so on. Then we talked a bit about file descriptors. So when we open files, the OS needs to keep track of that somehow. And on Unix systems, what they've chosen to do is that every process has a table of files that it has open, actually pointers to files. And, well, we have to have some special files like standard in, standard out, standard error. And the solution for that Unix came up with is that we'll just say 0, 1, and 2. Those are those. We'll just fix those by convention. And when you do an open, we just set a pointer in this table, and we return the index in the table. And when you're doing any sort of system call, you're just passing indices into this table for your process. And we learned that fork kind of duplicates this table of pointers, so they both, the child and the parent process, point to the same files. And we have other ways of manipulating the pointers in this table. So there's some obvious ones, like open sets a pointer that, well, there wasn't anything before, close nulls out a pointer, and we have Duke 2, which is for kind of assigning one to another. So this does a, you know, table of, I guess I'll do Y equals table of X. It does a pointer assignment. X, where we have Duke 2 of Y comma X. And we also learned about pipe. So sometimes something you want to do is, you know, take a program's output and put it into another program. And a way we can enable doing this is with pipe, which gives us a pair of file descriptors. So rather than going to a normal file first, like a file on disk, we can just have one file descriptor where, you know, when we write to that file, it goes to another file descriptor. And pipe gives us a pair of such file descriptors. Probably going to be very useful on the next homework, which is sort of an extension of the fork lab, where rather than just running a program, you're now going to run a program and collect its output, and run a bunch of programs in parallel and collect all their outputs collectively and wait for them all to finish. And that's the next homework coming up. We have it delayed from the fork lab because there's a fork lab solution if you didn't do it that you can refer to. Yes. So the question, when I close a file, does that zero at the entry, or is it like freeing it? So I would say neither. So an issue is if we want to do things like Duke 2 or fork, we can have two different table entries that point to the same place. And kind of like Java, where we can have multiple references to the same object, we want to make sure that, you know, that file that we're pointing to stays around as long as there's anything pointing to it. And the OS is responsible for doing that. So close just nulls out an entry, and if that's the last pointer to that file, it's going to free things. Otherwise, it's not. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk a little about anonymous feedback. So piece of anonymous feedback, I think, is probably going to complain is that, gosh, we have a lot of stuff in this class. Is the department going to like consider splitting this back into the topics it came from? So from a high level, probably not, because reorganizing the curriculum was a massive multi-year effort, and I don't think people want to repeat that for a while. The other thing is that, well, kind of like, I think we've always had the courses sort of in the set always ended up being a little broad. Even just the operating systems course, which is only operating systems, covers a rather broad range of topics because you go from exceptions, very low-level stuff, to like file systems, distributed systems, and that's traditionally been considered part of operating systems here. So, yeah, I don't think this is going to change, and I think like just these sort of topic areas tend to give us broad courses because we aren't like just doing an in-depth course on like the part of OSs that deal with system calls and running processes, for example, something like that. That would be usually considered too narrow for an OS course because we're missing like virtual memory, file systems, all logging in, counts, and all sorts of things, some of which we've covered. So then saying that, gosh, it's hard to get partial credit on the quizzes. So I agree this is something I need to think about how to deal with without making the quizzes ungradable. Probably I should try to encourage more use of the comments and or try to split up questions more. It's tricky to do that. Also saying, hey, couldn't we have prior quizzes to study from? If there were prior semesters of the course, I definitely would do that. I do that in all the classes where I do have those. I have access to the quizzes from the pilot. I'm not sure whether Luther Chukanovich would want me to release those, but I have access to them. Probably could talk about that. I'm not sure also if they're representative of what we ask this semester. And then someone saying, hey, you mentioned, I think a few weeks ago, you said, oh, sorry, I make so many mistakes with quizzes because I don't spend much time reviewing and writing these quizzes. And so I guess probably the context I said that in is like when I write quizzes, like I'm doing it in one day often if I have to adjust the quiz. So now we're typically doing it the week of. And it's not an insubstantial amount of effort, so it's probably like depends on the quiz, like a couple hours of writing. And I have every time I try to have two TAs read over the quiz. And believe it or not, yes, the number of other interpretations got past everyone, both of those TAs and me writing the quiz. This just happens when you have a class of like 200 and you have people reading the quiz who are mostly familiar with the material who don't think of other interpretations. And I guess why I would say this is not much time is because I'm comparing it to when I write a final. When I write a final, if my semester is not too busy, I like having the final basically written like a week ahead of time so I can go through it and have TAs go through it multiple times over that week. Obviously, that's not practical for the quiz setup, and that's what I mean when I say I don't spend much time doing it compared to like what I do for being paranoid about a final when I have enough time in the semester. It's also saying, hey, you make a lot of adjustments, and we see that like quiz grades change when you make these adjustments. Most of the adjustments I've made are, oh, this question has another interpretation that we didn't think of that makes an additional answer correct. That's usually the form of the adjustment. So it's not an issue with the question itself like not being answerable or not letting you practice the material. Sometimes there's exceptions, but it's usually it, so I'm not too concerned. But yes, I would like to magically be able to proofread things well, better than I can, which usually the problem is if I just wrote it, when I read it, you know, I skip over all the parts which are likely to be problems, which I'm sure a lot of people experience trying to proofread stuff just after writing it. So questions on anonymous feedback issues? Okay, so I'm going to go through, I think the quiz questions I want to go through are probably, I think this one was okay. So quiz question two. So question two were about some TLBs. And these TLBs had two sets, which we could tell because they had four entries and two ways. Therefore, they had two sets because the total number of entries, number of entries per way, for set times the number of ways, which is number of entries. Yeah. So we had total of four entries, which is two times two. So we had two sets. Yeah. So the question is, why is the index bit here the lowest order bit and not the second lowest order bit? So what we're doing that's on the slide is that we take our address, we remove the page offset because we're only using the virtual page number, and we look up the virtual page number. And when we look up the virtual page number, we divide it up into an index and a tag. There's no offset in there because, well, We only store one thing for a block, so there's no offset bits. And we make it the least significant bit because we're kind of assuming this spatial locality idea, where we want it to be the case that if we have two things that are adjacent to each other, that they both be stored in the cache. That's why we want it to be least significant and not some other bit, even though, yes, you could build a cache for it some other bit. And so we look at that index bit, and if the index bit matches, it's in the same set. If it doesn't, it's not in the same set. Yes? This question, why is there 12 page offset bit? Doesn't that mean that each byte in the page is an entry? So our entries in our TLB are page table entries, which tell us about the whole page. And the reason there are 12 page offset bits is because of the size of the pages, which is, I wrote wrong here, it's 4,096 bytes. And the page offset tells us where in a page we are, but the page table entry just tells us where is this whole page. So the question is, if our pages are 4096 bytes and our entries are 8 bytes, shouldn't there be 512 entries? So there'd be 512 entries that would fit in a page. But the entry is just data about a page. And
so if there are 512 entries, doesn't that mean
it
should be 9 offset bits?
Doesn't that mean it should be 9 offset bits? So the page table entry says, so let's say I have virtual page 0. Virtual page 0, that's the range of addresses from 0 to 4096. There's one page table entry in my page table set that tells me where that goes. That page table entry, which is 8 bytes, is what we're going to store in the TLB. We don't need any offset bits to know about that. We just need to know it's virtual page 0. So I look up with index all zeros. I found it has an index bit of 0, has a tag of 0, a bunch of zeros. I put that in my TLB, that one 8-byte page table entry. Now, I'm probably going to get that from a big page table, which probably has 512 entries in it. But that's not what we store in the TLB. We don't store whole page tables. We store a single part of them. And that single part of them tells us about a page of the program's data.
Right, that makes sense. I guess I just mean that, like, the number of page offset bits determines whatever the last number of bits is that determines the index, right? So that's why I was wondering, I guess, because it doesn't seem possible.
So the question is, doesn't say how long the entries in the pages are. So the reason we don't say that is because we're kind of, when we do the TLB lookup, we're taking our address and splitting it up into a virtual address, virtual page number, and a page offset. And as far as the TLB is concerned, that virtual page number to physical page number translation is a black box. It doesn't know how that works. So it doesn't care that, yes, we're storing those page table entries together and so on. All it cares is I could give a virtual page number and somehow I get a page table entry. So the fact that we split up that virtual page number further isn't going to matter here. Because as far as the TLB is concerned, that's just something else that, you know, it calls out to and gets a result. So if we think of our TLB homework, we call the translate function. We don't care how the translate function works. The same is true of this TLB. It doesn't care how the page table entry lookup works. So even though you're right, the page table entry lookup probably takes 9 bits of that virtual page number and does something with it. The TLB doesn't care about that because it's just calling it, getting the result back after that splitting happens. Does that answer your question?
Not really, but obviously.
So, okay. Other questions? And yeah, I'll try to follow up later. Yeah. Okay. So it's that question. And I think the other one really talk about is quiz question four. So in quiz question four, we have this lookup here. Here, and we have this paragraph that does a fork, and I've made a diagram of how things split up into child processes. So we do two fork calls in a row, and we're going to do the first fork call that's going to make a child process, and then that child's going to fork again, and that's going to make a grandchild process, and we have the original child process still running. And in our parent here, you know, on this side, PID 1 is greater than 0. And on this side, PID 1 is equal to 0. And here, PID 2 is greater than 0. And here, PID 2 is greater than 0. So there's only one place PID 1 and PID 2 is greater than 0, which is in the original parent. So that's the only process which is going to run the code that prints 2 and 3. And in between printing 2 and 3, it's going to run two wait PID calls. So the first one's going to wait for the first child process, this one here, to finish. This one's going to wait for the next one. And this means that we're going to print 1 before we print any of the 4s. Then we're going to print 2, potentially interleave with printing any of the 4s. And then we're going to print at least this 4 and this 4 before we print 3. But this other 4 that's printed out here in this grandchild process, we're not waiting for that from anywhere. So it could be printed out any time after 1 is printed. And that's how we get the possible orders. And then we print 3 and 4. So we always end with a 3 and a 4. We could have an additional 4 snuck in there because of this process here that we don't wait for from the parent process. So it could run any time, depending when the OS gets a time to run it. Questions? Example? Okay. And I guess I'll go over the last question on the quiz, which is quiz question 5, which was about Duke 2. So here, I've set up a bunch of file descriptors. So standard in, right now, points to probably our terminal. Pipe FD0 is the read end of the pipe. If you didn't remember which was read and write, you could have, if you looked at the man page, it tells you. The first like 5 times I taught about pipes, I had to do that every time. And pipe FD1 is the write end, and out FD goes to foo.txt. Then we run this dupe 2 call, and this is gonna make out FD be a copy of where pipe FDs point to. So they both now point to the same place, which is the right part of the pipe. And then we do a dupe 2 of the read part of the pipe to standard in. That means standard in now, instead of pointing to our terminal, points to the read part of the pipe. And I guess the big thing that people miss the most is that after we do this, out.txt isn't open. Why isn't it open? Because, well, we have no way of referring to it anymore. We dupe 2 overwrote it. So we probably accidentally closed it. And besides being a good example for understanding dupe 2, this is one of the most common mistakes to make on things like our upcoming homework. Yes?
Does it matter what was originally in pipefd0?
The question, does it matter what was originally in pipefd0 and pipefd1? By originally in, do you mean in at this point in time? It only matters if pipe fails. Because if pipe fails, it's not going to fill those in. We said to assume that pipe doesn't fail, but in real code, you'd want to do something like if pipe less than 0, you know, you'd want to have some code to handle it failing. Why would it fail? Like, say you're out of memory, for example. Yes?
What is the question A, the file, like the file foo.txt will be open? What does open mean?
That means that If a file is open, that means you have a open file description that you can use to access it somehow.
So you can like read or write?
So you can either read or write or do something to it without opening it again.
Okay.
Yes? Question, what are these two arguments after foo.txt? So this is one argument here, and this is an integer that is formed by ORing together two special constants. That means open for writing and create the file if it doesn't exist already. And you can look up in the open man page exactly what the whole set of these constants are, you know, if you want them. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there, or further back. Yeah, you. So question, what's the difference between a pipe and an array of two file descriptors? So not only does pipe give us two different file descriptors, the file descriptors are set up such that if I do a write to pipe FDs of one, of say A, then if I read from pipe FDs of zero into somewhere, C will become A. It will send A from one to the other. So they're connected, which two random file descriptors probably wouldn't be. Does that answer your question? Yes? Can I explain why?
Oh, sorry. What line is foo.txt close?
Question, what line closes foo.txt? That happens in this first stupe 2, and we can tell because before we have a file descriptor that refers to foo.txt, after we do not. Yes?
What happens if the event yes, like one of its indices, what happens if that's the second argument of
dupe2? Question, what happens if I pass one of the pipe FD's indices as the second argument to dupe2? Like we saw happen without FD, we will overwrite that file descriptor, and it will now refer to something else if we try to use it.
So the pipe would still be able to read and write.
So the question is, the pipe would still be able to read and write? So we'd only be able to read and write if we had some file descriptor that pointed to read pipe or write pipe afterwards. So if I did, for example, if I did, let's say, I'll do this in a different color. If I say dupe 2 pipe FDs 1 to pipe FDs 0, what would that do? Is, well, out FD would still be foo.txt because it was before, but pipe FD0 would now point to the right end of the pipe, and we'd have no way of reading from the pipe. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
I read in the main man page that if you try to write the read ahead of the pipe, it causes like an exception error, perhaps causes the return an error bound. Does that mean that there's some permissions bits, like what you define as like the open that defines additional permissions by the file entry?
So the question is, you said if you try to write to the read end of a pipe, you get an error. Does that mean there's some permissions associated with the file descriptor? Yes. So just like when you open a file for reading, you can't write to it, file descriptors have the same kind of information associated with them to indicate what operations you can do with them. And the OS enforces that when you make the system calls that implement read and write. Yes?
The question is, what's the difference between
an instruction TLB and a data TLB? So when we run an instruction, we have to fetch the actual instructions. That uses the instruction cache and the instruction TLB. And we have but when the instructions say to do something that accesses something that's not instructions, or probably not instructions, that uses the data cache and data TLB. Does that answer your question?
Okay. So when we move something into Rex, are we always going to access the instruction TLB?
So the question is, when we move something into Rex, are we always going to access the instruction TLB? So when we run an instruction, we always have to fetch the instruction's machine code. That's always going to use the instruction cache and the instruction TLB. Doesn't matter what the instruction does, in fact. Okay. Other questions? So talk about, just mentioned, I mentioned this last time, lab tomorrow is sort of on some ideas for synchronization, since that's the topic we're going to start today. It's in-person checkoff only. If you can't make it, contact me, but don't expect to do it somewhere else. That won't work. So our next topic is going to be about threats. And we're going to deal with kind of two big concepts, and one of which we've started to see. So concurrency is this idea of doing multiple things at once. And we've seen this with fork, that we fork, we have two different programs that can run at the same time, and we're doing two different things, but they're happening at the same time, possibly actually at the same time, like we have multiple cores, and possibly kind of simulated at the same time, like we're doing this context switching idea with time multiplexing. But in either case, things appear to happen at the same time. And this comes up a bunch when we have in real programs that we'll have one program that wants to do multiple things at the same time. So like, you know, if we have a web server, we might want to serve multiple users, and maybe a convenient way of doing that is to have one thread for every user. Or if we have a web browser, we might want threads for different web pages that can execute the code that the web page needs to execute separately from the other and kind of simultaneously. We're also going to talk a bit about this idea of parallelism, that we want to actually do multiple things at the same time. Often, do a single thing using different resources, like using multiple cores at the same time to accomplish one big task. And we're going to have a homework assignment on something that's a classic example of parallelism, where we want to do one thing, but rather than doing it, you know, on just one thing at a time, you want to do multiple things together to get more performance. But it's not like this concurrency example where we're doing different things and they're happening at the same time. Here, we're doing kind of the same task, but in pieces, so we can take advantage of more resources. That, in particular, so we can use multiple cores at the same time to hopefully get more performance. So we're going to talk about threads. And we've mentioned that threads sort of are this idea that we have a sequence of instructions we run. Typically, we have our own stack, our own registers, and so on. And so far, we've seen just single-threaded processes. So processes and threads have kind of been intertwined. And in a single-threaded process, we have a thread with its stack, our registers, our program counter, and we have our memories, our code, and our data, our heap, and we have our files that are open, and so on. We can also have multi-threaded processes where we have some open files, a process idea, we have our memory with our code and our data and so on, but we have multiple threads, each of which has their own register values, their own program counter, and their own stack. And we're going to talk about how to deal with having these multi-threaded processes as our next big topic. And kind of our power and what's going to make things complicated is going to come from the fact that, well, this multi-threaded process, we have the data and the files are all shared between all these threads. All these threads have the same data, same heap, and so on. All this, they share the memory with everything else, and they share the files with everything else in that process. Some questions about our multiple threads here. So let's look at the Unix, the POSIX API, which is going to be called pthreads for POSIX threads. This is the Unix API that we're going to be using on Linux. And the function for creating a new thread in the current process is called pthread create. So here I have code where I have this compute by function, this print class list function, and I'm just going to run them both at the same time. And what I do here is I call this pythread here, well, sorry, I call pthread create with passing a pointer to this pythread to fill in. So pthread t is basically a thread ID, so it's kind of like a process ID. Because pthread create returns as error code, which I'm not checking here because I'm saving space on my slides by writing bad code, because it returns an error code, it returns the thread ID, but you pass a pointer to fill in the thread ID. But that's a thread ID is basically just a number for the thread, just like a process ID is a number for our processes. And I pass a function to run for the thread for both of these. And this function runs in the current process, but with a new thread, meaning a new program counter, a new register, and that's going to run at the same time in concurrently with everything else in the process. So I call pthread create here, and this compute pi thread starts running. At the same time, my main function is still running. It gets to go on. Then I call print class list, and that print class list starts running, and my main function is still running. And they're all running, conceptually at least, at the same time. If we have three cores, maybe they're actually running at the same time. If we don't have three cores, then the OS is going to be context switching between these, just like it would context switch between different processes. So questions about this setup? Yes?
So if it was just like one single thread, would it be faster just to call each function individually instead of using
the thread? So question, if it was just one single core, would it be faster to just call these functions individually? So that depends on what we're doing exactly. So if we think of print class list, for example, maybe this function needs to wait to be able to put something to the screen or to the network. In that case, while it's waiting, it would be better if we could like run part of compute pi during that waiting time. Does that answer your question? Yes, over there.
What benefit does this have over just forking?
What benefit does this have over just forking? So because we're sharing all this code and data, we're not making a copy. We're not even doing copy on write stuff. We don't have an additional page table. So it should be faster to make a thread than to make a new process. And also, because we're sharing this memory, if we wanted to like read the results of pi that were computed, well, we can do that because our compute pi function could just put them in the data that we can just access. Does that answer your question? Yes. If I had only one core, would the threads just be context switching with each other? Yes, and potentially also with other things on your system. Yes, back there.
What are those null arguments supposed to be?
I will get to that on the next slide. And way back.
Same one.
OK. So let's talk about these extra arguments here. So let's talk about what the arguments are. So our first argument is a place to put the thread identifier, which is just like a process ID. It's just a number which identifies the thread. And we have this function to run. This is where the thread starts. And when this function exits, the thread terminates. Then I have this two extra arguments. So the first one are thread attributes. So these are some extra settings for the thread. I'm passing null, meaning I want all the defaults. But if we wanted to have the thread run in a different way, there are various settings. We'll show one example later that you can configure using this second argument. This last argument here, this is what's passed as the argument to the function. So compute pi is called with null. If we wanted to call it with something else, like let's say we called it with foo, that we would pass foo as that argument, and then it would call compute pi of foo instead of compute pi of null when it runs the thread. So this is the one thing we have to pass to the thread. And this is going to be useful for running a whole bunch of threads, you know, where we might need to have them do different things. How do we tell the thread what to do? We can pass this one argument that's a pointer to whatever information we want. That can tell the thread, what do you do when you start? That can even work if we're running, you know, threads where multiple threads that use the same function to run. We'll see some examples of that later. Yes?
Is there multiple arguments? How does that work in pthread create?
So question, what if there are multiple arguments? So for pthread create, the function you supply must take a void star argument and must return void star. If you want more arguments, sorry, you need to handle that some other way. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Question?
Question, what does the void store argument do? So in this example, probably not very much, because we're passing null. But in general, if I wanted to pass some information to this function, rather than having it figure out what to do through like global variables, the argument is my way of doing that. Does that answer your question? So I can, because it's a void star, I can take a pointer to something, pass it to that function, and I can look at that pointer and figure out, what am I asking you to do? So for example, let's say I want to pass a class list to this print class list function. I could put in this argument here a pointer to that class list so it could retrieve it, rather than it like using a global variable to find it. Does that answer your question? Yes. What is the difference between void star and other star types? So void star is a type in C that's a pointer to anything. And the idea is that, you know, no matter what type it really points to, you convert it to a void star to store it for code which doesn't know what it really points to. And in the case of pthread create, well, the pthread library doesn't know what your pointer really points to, so it uses a void star. Yes? Question, I said the functions I put in have to return void star? Yes. So you see here, the return type is void star. Yeah. Can I explain the second argument? Second argument are what's called thread attributes. So if there's extra settings you want that control how the thread's created, that's where you put them. We haven't seen what any of those extra settings are, but we'll come across some a little later. Other questions? Yes, back there. Yeah.
So if it returns, if pi returns void star, how do I access that void star?
How do we access that void star? We will get to that later, I promise. Yeah.
So which null is the function argument, which is the thread?
Question, which null is the function argument, which is the thread attributes? The first one is the thread attribute. The second one is the argument. Other questions? Okay, so let's do this exercise for here. So here's a program, and what I do is I print about to start thread, then I create a thread to run this print message function, passing null to it, it stores the argument. That print message function prints in the thread and then returns. Then I print done starting thread and I return. And on my machine, I ran this a whole bunch of times. And it outputs in the thread as part of the output. It always outputs about the start thread, done starting thread. But it only outputs in the thread about 4% of the time. So what happened? Any ideas about what happened here? Yeah.
You didn't call like a thread join command, so it just instantly exited after you created
the thread. Yeah, so you're saying it exited after I created the thread. So that's why I didn't see the thread's output. Now, why did that happen all the time, though? So that would mean, so you're saying that, well, I'm not waiting for this thread to finish, and I'm just exiting. So of course I don't see the thread's output. But the thing is, I see it 4% of the time. Why do I see it sometimes? Yeah.
Because you either context switch or you end up popping into the thread.
So you're saying, oh, sometimes I'll context switch to the new thread before I manage to exit, and sometimes I won't. That's what's happening here, is that we have what we might know as a race condition, that my unlucky case, that basically I'm running main, and main's going to finish. And when main finishes, it exits the entire process, including this extra thread we have running. And sometimes that thread manages to run long enough before that happens that it prints out in the thread. Sometimes it doesn't. And when that happens, that depends on exactly when my OS is context switching to the thread and when it's not. Which depends a lot on exactly what's going on in the system, exact timings. And so it's kind of indeterminate. Yeah.
Threads use the same process, so when that process, like when we switch to another process called thread stop.
So the question is, threads use the same process, so when we switch to another process, all threads stop. So what I would say is, let's think of what the OS is doing between switching and switching to individual threads. And when the OS switches to a thread, that thread could be in any process. And if it's in a different process, it's going to handle switching to that process as part of switching to the thread. But if we have a process with five threads, the OS could be running all five of them at once, or it could run two from one process and it can run some threads on another process. So it can do any combination at once. Does that clarify that? Yeah. So I wouldn't say we're switched to a process or not. We're switched to a thread of a process, and as part of doing that, we're going to set up the page table for that so the thread can run and so on. Yeah?
Is there a limit on how many threads can run once? So what if I want to copy threads within quick message?
So the question, is there a limit to how many threads I can run at once? Yes. And it's mostly how many the OS is configured to let you run and how much memory you have. Other questions? Yeah?
Does it not have to do with how many threads your CPU has?
Question, does it not have to do with how many threads your CPU has? So, how many threads your CPU has is how many can actually run at once. But remember, we have this idea of context switching. So the OS will handle the fact that I don't have, four threads the hardware will run at the same time, but I have, 20 threads the program wants to run. It's going to assign those four of those 20 threads to run at a time and switch between them. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So, one of the answers alluded to the fix is that there's a join function to wait for a thread to finish. So the join function will wait for a thread to finish, and it also takes this extra argument, and this is where to store the return value. In this case, I pass a null, I just say I don't care about the return value. But if we wanted it, we use that argument to specify where to put it. Questions? Yes, yeah. Can I explain what the join does? So the join is kind of the equivalent of wait PID for threads. So just like wait PID waits for something to finish and gets its exit status, join waits for the thread to finish if it's not already and gets its return value. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, is there a way to wait for a thread to reach a particular point but not necessarily finish? Yes. And we're going to talk about lots of ways of doing that. And the most intuitive one is going to be barriers, which we're going to talk about probably later this week. But yes, we'll have lots of ways of doing that because that is a very important problem. Yeah?
Is there a notion of process ID for
Question, is there a notion of process ID for threads? Our pthread T contains a This will contain a thread ID. E, so there is a thread ID, that's what that's going to contain, and there's an equivalent of get PID, which is pthread self, which is like get PID, so yes, there's really an equivalent for that, and it's pthread. Yeah? Question, is pthread t a struct or is it just an integer? Most commonly it's an integer, but I don't think that's guaranteed. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so another thing we can do is we can exit, use pthread exit, rather than returning from main. And the pthread exit function exits the current thread, but doesn't exit the whole process. So it turns out the reason why we were exiting before is that this return 0 does implicitly an exit 0, and exit is exit the whole process. But there's a pthread exit, which is just exit the current thread. I don't recommend this, as it said on the slides, but mention that you know, the reason we have this problem is because returning from main exits the whole process, and that's just how that is defined to work, but we could define it to just exit the current thread. And if we want to do that, there's a function to do that. Just exits one thread, leaves all the other threads running, just as they were before. Yes? Question, what's the difference between exit and underscore exit? So I wrote that returning 0 for main is equivalent to exit of 0. So exit of 0 exits a process with exit status 0, and before doing that, it does some cleanup. For example, it flushes standard out. The underscore exit function, exit with status 0, but doesn't do that cleanup. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The question is, that if I had printed something standard out and hadn't appeared yet, exit 0 would print out anything that's buffered and underscore exit wouldn't? Yes. And there's some other things like that that are differences where exit does cleanup work like flushing buffers and underscore exit doesn't. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you explain the argument for pthread exit?
Can I explain the argument for pthread exit? The argument is the return value of the thread. So it's the equivalent of returning null from the thread function, just like exit 0 is equivalent of returning 0 from main.
Is it like an exit code?
Is it like an exit code? It's the closest thing a thread has to an exit code, but it's a the return value is a pointer rather than a number. Other questions? Okay, so we have pthread join and pthread exit. So now that we know about these functions, I had these kind of toy examples. Let's think about using these to try to take advantage of multiple cores. So I'm going to do a very simple task of summing up an array. I have an array of 1,024 entries called values up here. And I'm going to sum it up using two cores, hopefully. And the way I'm going to do that is I have two functions, sumFront sums the first half of the array, sums the back half of the array, second half. And what am I going to do? I'm going to run both of these functions in separate threads, wait for both of the threads to finish, and then rather than using the return value that pthread gives me, I'm just going to have them write the results to this global variable here, and then add those results up at the end. Questions about this code? Yes.
Does each thread have its own heap, or is there like one heap for all threads?
The question is, does each thread have its own heap? So let's talk about the memory layout. I have a slide for this. So when these threads are running, each thread is going to have its own stack, but everything else is going to be part of the same memory and shared. So we're going to have our own heap, our own global variable space for the, or heap and global variable space for the process shared between all the threads, and you know, we're going to access stuff, you know, in that shared space. We'll have these global variables that both threads are going to access. Their PCs are going to point to the sum front and sum back functions that's in that shared space. So this is what the memory layout's going to look like. So unlike making a new process, we'll have most of the stuff is shared, and even the stuff that isn't shared, well, you know, we could hypothetically make a pointer to one of these thread stacks and dereference that pointer and access it, but we probably shouldn't. So questions about scenario? Yes?
If I change, say I have like some heap allocated memory, and I change something in one thread, would that be reflected in the other?
So the question is, if I change something in one thread, will that be reflected in another? Yes, because we are going to literally, if we have something in the heap, for example, we're going to see it in another thread. Or we have an example of that here, where when I change results of 0 in the thread, that's going to be visible in the sumAll function later on. Even though, because they actually share that results array. All the memory is shared by default. Yes? So the question is, will compilers do this for you? I'm not aware of C compilers that will do that except with very special settings that are not, you are not likely to set unless you're specifically trying to do this. Yes. Question, with more interpreted languages like Python or Java, would they perhaps do this? I think it's unlikely. Where you will see this sort of thing happen is if there's a library function called sub, that library function might do this internally, but it's not because it's transforming your for loop that does a sum to that, it's because someone wrote a fast sum function, and they figured out, oh, the way I make sum fast is I use threads. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Yeah. So the question is, this would only be faster if we have multiple cores. So that is one condition that need for it to be faster. There's some other conditions for it to be faster. It needs to be faster to start two threads than it is to sum 512 numbers. And that's actually probably not true. But it would be true if we had like maybe 100 million numbers. But yeah, so, but yes, we need multiple cores and we need, there's gonna be overheads like allocating stack space, starting the new threads, allocating the space for all their registers and so on, the times, you know, getting the OS to run it on a core, you know, that needs to happen, and if that's too slow, it's not gonna be faster. Other questions? Okay. So, this works, but something that you might find kind of annoying here is I have a little bit of code duplication because I need to have these two versions of the function. We might not want to do that. That's kind of bad style, and it's really annoying if I like want to use four. Now I have to write four sum functions or eight. So what can we do instead? And something we can do instead is we can try to take advantage of that argument. So here I have one sum function for the threads to run, and it takes an argument, and what I've done is I've shoved into a pointer an integer, and I just convert it to a pointer and then convert it back to an integer. And that integer is either gonna be 0 or 1, and that tells which version of the code to run. So if it's 0, this loop is gonna go from 0 to 512, and if it's 1, this loop is going to go from 512 to 1024. And how do I start it with the different numbers? Well, I have this loop, and I pass I converted to a pointer. So I is either 0 or 1, so when you convert it back to an integer, we're either going to get 0 or 1. Yes? The question is, when do these other threads run? Is any time between the pthread create and when the pthread join is finished? Yep. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, would this be thread safe? So we'll talk about race conditions later, but the main issue for thread safety is, do we have two things that are trying to, something that's trying to write while something else might be reading? And in this case, we have avoided that because each thread only writes to its ID's entry of results. So there's no overlap there. And we only read from results after the threads have definitely finished. And there's nothing like printf. We aren't like printing to the same file or anything like that. We don't have other things where the two threads might be stepping on each other's toes. Yes?
So you pass I as a void pointer, but it doesn't actually need to point to a real location in memory, because you can just
pass it again in your function, is that right?
So the question is, I passed I to a void pointer, but it doesn't point to a real location memory? Yes. So I'm just using the pointer to store an integer. The only reason I'm casting is because pthreads is silly and only lets me pass pointers. It doesn't let me pass integers. So I'm just saying, oh, well, pointer's really an integer, and taking advantage of that. Yeah?
So even though the two threads would be accessing the same array of values, because they're not trying to access the same index like at the same time, they would be fine, right? Is that what you're saying?
So the question is, even though both threads are accessing results, it's okay because they're not accessing the same index at the same time? Yes. And we'll try to be a little more precise about that type of issue later. Other questions? Okay, so this is probably looks better to you from a code duplication perspective. Maybe the code's ugly, but at least we don't have two copies of it. But we can do maybe a little more systematic. So rather than just passing a whole, just a number, we could pass more information. So what I can do is I'll just pass this whole struct. So I can't pass three arguments, but I can pass a pointer to a struct. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make an array of these structs. I'm going to fill in the array with my start and end location, which I'm just going to compute before I start the threads. And I'm going to have these structs actually be used to return the result, that the thread is going to fill in the result in the struct, and I'm just going to read it out after the thread's finished. At the bottom here, we're just read out the two results. So questions about my code organization here? Yeah?
Is it like convention to have the, I guess like the implied result in argument type be the same?
Question, is it convention to have the implied result in argument type be the same? It's not, what do you mean implied result in argument type? Is it convention to have it be void start? So this is required by the pthreads library, because the reason why is because the type, the way that pthread create is declared, the third argument has to be a function that returns a void start and takes a void start, or else you'll get a type mismatch.
Sorry, I just meant for the thread, it's implied that this function, it takes in a thread and throws an argument and returns a thread.
Question, it's implied that this function takes in a thread info as an argument in the some thread, I mean?
Okay, maybe it is that.
I should have a typedef struct thread info. Yes. And I ported this poorly from C++, so there should be a typedef to be able to use thread info there. But as far as what type the functions create, the thread functions have to take a void star, and I've chosen that we're going to pass a thread info to them. They don't actually return anything. They return null, I should say. Nothing useful. The way we get their result is that they put it somewhere useful for us, and that location is in the thread info itself. But pthreads gives us this return value, I should say, and I haven't used it yet. Just returning null every time. Yeah?
Am I seeing it right that for when you do the pthread create and your passive address of the structures for info I, can you pass a local variable as an argument?
So the question is, wait a moment, you're passing a local variable pointer to these functions. Why isn't this a problem? So let's talk about the memory layout. So I have a picture for this. So both of these functions are going to have pointers to parts of that array that's on the main thread stack. And this would be a problem if the main thread stack went away or we deallocated stuff from it. But we know, because we're doing this pthread join here, that it doesn't. Okay. It does go away eventually, but it doesn't go away until the threads are done, so it's not going to matter. Questions set up here. Right. Duplicate one. So far I've had something where we call a function and the whole threads run during that function. Let's say we want to start these threads and have them do something in the background and then collect the results later. We can do that too. So here I have a start function, and right, I should have converted this from C++ to C. So pretend this new is calloc, and pretend this delete is free. I will correct these slides later. But what we can do is we can just allocate some heap space to store that values, and then we can come back to it later and join the threads later. In this case, I stored the thread ID in the struct itself, just because that was a convenient place to put it. And in this way, I can call this start function, do a bunch of other stuff, call the finish function. The finish function will wait for the functions to finish if they haven't already, and collect the results, and then free up our heap space. And what ends up happening is we have some space on the heap that stores up that array and points to our values, and that's how that works. So I've shown you a bunch of options for passing things to threads, and this was going to come up on our sort of first threading homework assignment, which is the life one. You know, this is going to be how we can actually sort of usefully pass values to threads without putting everything in global variables, which usually doesn't really work out in a real program as something you want to do. People will complain about it at the least, or if you want the threads to do different things at different times, it's really hard to do with global variables. Some questions about our sum examples. Okay, so let's do a different example here. So here I have some code that is bad. There's a problem with this code. So we start a thread, it computes a string, returns it, and finally I'm using that pthread join ability to pass an argument, pass return values, and there's a problem. What's the problem? Yeah.
This parse string and the create string function is on the stack.
Okay.
So when you return a string, it's deallocating the stack, and therefore when you try to use it again, it's not there.
Okay, so you're saying, oh, this string here, this is on the stack, and when I return, that stack space goes away. And in fact, it's worse than that. It's on, you know, the stack of this new thread, and when the thread exits, the whole stack goes away. And when it joins, the whole stack goes away. So we have a pointer to the stack, which now doesn't exist at all. There's not even a stack there anymore. So that's not going to work. So what would we do instead? Any proposals? Just do a malloc. So that would be another idea. So if we did sort of malloc here, that would be fixed. And of course, in that case, we need to somehow free down. But if we know we're allocating the stack space, and the stack can hold my 1 kilobyte string here, we're asked, well, how much stack space are we actually allocating? And how do we know when the stack gets free? So when you create a thread, we're going to allocate a stack, and we'll call a thread control block. This is going to be our space for the OS to track registers, PC, and all that information. So that's what we're going to allocate in a thread. The question is, when is this deallocated? And, well, we can deallocate the stack when the thread exits, but we have to actually keep around information about the thread until we collect the return value, because that return value, that's going to have to be sitting there waiting for us to collect it even after the thread has exited. And this means that a common idea that you might have is, well, let's just start a thread and ignore it. That doesn't work out very well because we'll never actually free up all the thread's resources if you don't join it. But there's a problem here. What if I don't care about the thread's return value and when it finishes? What if I just want to run a thread and forget about it? So let's say I have an example here. I have a thread that just shows progress. I don't care about waiting for that thread to finish. It's going to finish on its own, and that's fine. How do I avoid needing to join it and not have a memory leak? And there's a function for this, which is detach. So detach says, I don't care about how this thread's return value. I'm not going to join it. When it exits, just get rid of it. Don't keep around information about it for me to collect with join. Just get rid of it. So detach is a function to request this behavior for a thread. And in this example, I created the thread and then asked to detach it so I don't need to join it later. I also could have done this with that second argument to pthreads create, I told you, sets extra settings for the thread. So I can, when I start the thread, I can say, here are some attributes, and the attribute is please make it detached when it starts. I'm never going to join this thread. Just set it up that way when you start it. So questions about this detached idea? Yes? Can I explain the purpose of pthread detach? So normally, I need to collect the return value of threads. If I don't do this, then the thread stuff is not going to be completely deallocated. So I'm going to leak memory. But sometimes I don't care about the return value. I don't even care when the thread finishes. Detach is a way for me to tell the OS about my preference there. Telling it that I don't care about joining this thread, just get rid of it, don't leak memory. Does that answer your question?
So detach just tells the OS that you don't care about the return value and it prevents memory leaks, is that what you're saying?
This question is, detach tells the OS I don't care about the return value and prevents memory leaks? Yes, it tells it I don't care about even joining the thread. I don't want to wait for it. Just let it finish and get rid of it. Other questions? Yeah?
If you do pthread exit and then have the, like, where to store the value as null, isn't that, like, the same thing?
The question, if I do pthread exit and pass null, isn't that the same thing? So when I call pthread join, it's going to tell me what the value that was passed to pthread exit is. So if we go back to this example here, like, if this was my call to pthread join, the OS has to track, do I put a null in there or do I put something else? And if I did pthread exit of null, it has to remember you put a null in there instead of something else. It has to track that information. It also has to remember that this thread actually exited, so pthread join can return even if I'm not passing a return value. With pthread detach, it doesn't need to remember that because it knows you're not going to call pthread join, so I don't even need to keep track of this thread being something that finished. I can just forget about it totally. Does that answer your question? Question, you can call pthread join after you call pthread exit? Yes. The same way that when I process exits, I can call wait PID after it has already finished to collect its exit status and check that it actually finished. So pthread join doesn't care whether the thread finished yet or not. It's still going to work. So, you know, because otherwise, how would we wait for it to finish reliably if we don't know exactly when it's going to finish? Does that answer your question? Other, go back to our slide here. Other questions on detection? Yeah? Can I show an example of detached thread with other threads?
Yeah, like, I guess how would the process like end?
So in this example, our detached thread is probably showing the progress of some operation. And what's going to happen is that we're going to do whatever we want to do. In this example, like, we're going to run this code in main here, right? That code is going to keep running. And if main exits, the whole process exits, so the thread gets killed, so that thread goes away. Otherwise, you know, if the thread exits earlier, it just exits. So this is kind of equivalent to, like, in your shell, if you run a program in the background and you don't expect it to interfere with your shell, we're doing the same thing with threads. Does that clarify things? So, like, if you start your web browser in your shell, you expect to run other commands, and you don't care about when the web browser actually exits. Like, this lets us do that kind of thing, but with a thread in our process instead of, like, the web browser in your shell. Yeah? Question, did the contents of the thread stack set cleared, or is it just deallocated? It's deallocated, and like after it's deallocated, you're not allowed to access it, so you couldn't know if it's cleared. Other questions? Yeah.
What's the difference between detach and exit?
So detach is something we do instead of joining. Exiting is something the thread does. So the thread exits, either by calling pthread-exit or returning. And the question is, where does that, what does that do? Normally, what that does is it waits for someone to call join, and that handles it. If we detached, then it doesn't wait for someone to call join, it just gets rid of everything. Does that answer your question? Yeah. The question is detach just inside of the thread function? So in this example, detach is not inside of the thread function. The thread function is here. I'm just creating a thread and marking the thread I created as something I'm not joining. So instead of joining the thread, I'm calling detach to tell the OS, I'm never going to join this. Don't worry about it. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Can I explain the difference between exit and pthread exit? The exit function exits all the threads in the process. So if we go back to this diagram here, pthread exit says get rid of a thread. Okay. The exit function says get rid of the whole process. That answer your question? Okay. So one other thing. So you saw the attributes can be used to set threads to start as something we'll never join. We can also use it to set things like the stack size. So when we make a thread, we have to allocate a stack. You might say, how big is that? Well, it's pretty big by default, but if you want to set a different size, you can set one. So in this example, I'm setting a 32 kilobyte stack instead of whatever the default is, which is probably like a couple hundred kilobytes or something. Yeah?
So new stacks are some from the same virtual address space, right?
Question, the new stacks are in the same virtual address space? Yes. So the stacks are allocated similarly to mallocing them. Other questions? Yeah.
Then you have a different virtual memory space, like a different full stack of threads.
So the question, if I were to create a new process, then I have a different virtual memory space? Yes. So for example, when I call fork, I have the same stack address, but it now refers to completely different completely different memory. When I do pthread create, I have a new stack address, which refers to new memory, but if I have the old stack address in a pointer somewhere, I can still access that. And we saw that example in this, not this case, but this case here, where we were accessing something on another thread stack through a pointer. Okay, so there. So our next topic is going to be about synchronization, which is incidentally what our lag, oh, I should talk about error checking, yes. So we have a minute. So note on error checking. So pthread create has a return value. I've never used it on these slides, but you should probably check it. I was just saving space, but if you'd like to know when pthread create fails, you should probably check the return value. The same is true for like pthread join and most of the other pthread functions. If you'd like to know when they fail instead of just having your program do something weird, check the return out. So our topic for next time is going to be, gosh, when we have the situation like this, we have this non-determinism, that we have this kind of random outcome. And this happens all the time, and we're going to talk about mechanisms for dealing with this. And that's going to be our next big topic for several lectures, is all about mechanisms for dealing with that non-determinism.